It's a pleasure to be here again after the COVID break, and I'm going to talk about vortices. Vortices are everywhere. You can find them in bus tub, and they actually used in the concept of mirror symmetry, dualities, or whatever. Right. So let me put it a little bit in the context, and of course, the most interesting application is the condensed matter. Everybody is familiar with the vortices in superfluids and superconductors. Recently, the theory of vortices, and especially the theory of fermionic zero mods in vortex background, became extremely hot in the context of the possible experimental observation of so-called Majorana fermions in two-dimensional heterostructures, right? So if you're an arrogant particle theorist and hate all this stuff, you can think about the vortices as cosmic strings and the fermionic zero mods as superconducting cosmic strings, right? But I should warn you that, or actually let you know that recently, condensed matter guys were pretty much successful in physical realization of a cool concept from quantum field theory. And let me draw a little table, right? So, I don't know, Hawking radiation. Or axions. Or magnetic monopoles. What else? Majorana fermions. So, and if you put here, for example, condensed matter and particle theory, so here we will have, and here we have. So if you haven't yet made up your mind about your future in physics, after looking at this table, you should think twice, right?
Well, particle physics, of course, because it doesn't matter if it's done.
That is true. There is a little difference. If you find anything in this column, you get a Nobel Prize. If you find anything here, you get a paper in science, right? I mean, then you should basically choose your priorities, right? But anyhow, for me, to a very large extent, I the most interesting part of this talk, of this analysis, is the kind of new asymptotic method in the theory of solitons. Okay, let's go on, and it's a really short sketch of the talk. So I will start with an introduction. Very brief overview of the vortex theory, and we'll show you some pictures of real giant vortices in Bose-Einstein condensate, which are cool, and then I will switch to the theory of giant vortices. The main idea of the analysis which I'm going to present is to use the expansion in large topological charge or winding number. To my knowledge, nobody has done it for any system so far. So we will go over this, and finally I will show you how this result can be applied to find a solution for the Majorana mods of giant vortices. And again, this is pretty cool because these things are now studied by condensed matter experimentalists, and there are some controversies there, and hopefully our result will allow to solve this controversy.
So just to understand, so they realize the giant vortices in GAC, you say, and these are global vortices, but then in superconductors?
The Abrikosov, I have the solution for both, but I will talk mainly about Abrikosov, about gauge vortices. The global vortices are very interesting, and this is the first physical system where I have seen Penleveau transcendental like in the solution. But again, it's maybe, I mean, I have it, the slides, but probably we will not, I will run out of time, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, so.
But in superconductors, they also see a giant vortex as well.
Yes, right? Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Giant means n equal 4.
Okay.
4 is a very large number, you know, compared to 1. But anyhow, so this is the, like, basically all the work was done in collaboration with my undergraduate and graduate students. Okay, let's start with some basics. Again, I will sketch it very briefly. So here you can see the famous Ginzburg-Landau functional, which describes the free energy of a superconductor, right, of the Cooper pair condensate with the density phi squared in a magnetic field. So for particle physicists, it's just an Euclidean action for abelian Higgs model. So basically, we know what happens there. So it's spontaneous symmetry breaking. You have a condensate of Cooper pairs, and the magnetic field becomes massive, and it's expelled from superconductor. It's a famous Meissner effect. Minima of this functional correspond to stationary states. And the ground state, is f equal to 0. So you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, and the vacuum configuration is this one, right? So where alpha is an arbitrary smooth gauge function. So it turns out, and actually Abrikosov was the first guy who found it, that there are local minima of this functional, which like string-like, right, which have finite tension, means finite density of free energy per unit length, right? And let's just discuss again very briefly the main features of them, right? First of all, if we have finite tension, so at infinity we should get the vacuum configuration, and if we want the phi field to be continuous, the corresponding phase should be 2 pi n periodic, where n is some integer. It's called Winding number. So we have actually a mapping of the polar angle into the phase angle. So S1 to S1, it has a non-trivial homotopy group, right? So this basically means that every field configuration with finite tension belongs to one of the characteristic classes, right? I mean, so characterized by this integer number n. And this is valid for any, for global vortices, for gauge vortices. For gauge vortices, one can rewrite this winding number in a very nice way. So it's a kind of a trivial algebra plus the three-dimensional Stokes theorem. So one reduces it or rewrite it in terms of the two-dimensional integral and the integrand. I mean, again, so if you are a mathematician, you say that it's a first Chern class. If you are a physicist, you say that it's just a component of magnetic field parallel to the string. So this integral is just the total magnetic flux, and this equation tells you that the vortex carries an integer number of the flux quanta. So again, this is a very well-known fact, but we will use them, right, later to construct the non-trivial solutions. So basically from this consideration, we somehow figure out the universal feature of vortices. I mean, basically, there should be some inner region where our symmetry, our theory is in the symmetric phase, where you have no scalar field and the magnetic field is non equal to zero. So this is the region where this the total flux is saturated. And there is an outer region where you have a symmetry broken phase, you have basically vacuum configuration, right? So remember this, we will use this as a hint in what follows.
Can I ask you about this?
Yeah.
As soon as you cool down, until the material is superconducting, I guess, as soon as you cool down, the vortexes form, or you need to keep cooling down a bit more?
Sorry, like, could you, what?
So you have this material, you cool it down, it becomes, say, superconducting.
Yeah.
Then you see the vortices immediately?
No, you should apply external field, magnetic field. Of course, you will not have, yeah.
With magnetic field.
Yes, yes.
So
basically, you take a superconductor of the second kind, mm-hmm. and you apply the external field. And if it's of the first kind, right, I mean, so basically at some critical value of the field, the superconductor is destroyed, right? So it turns into the normal phase. If it's a superconductor of the second type, so the magnetic field starts to penetrate in through the superconductor in the form of the vortices. So this configuration minimizes the free energy.
And how do you see it? How do you see
you can make an X image of it.
You actually make an
image? Yeah, sure. And they form the lattice, very nice lattice, and yeah. So Abrikosov got a Nobel Prize for them, but he was wrong. He predicted a kind of rectangular lattice, and the lattice is triangular, actually. So, but anyhow.
Hexagonal.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Can I have a question?
Okay, so.
There was a question from Zoom, so.
Yeah.
What is the meaning of finite tension?
Finite tension means that the finite amount of free energy per, it's a local minimum, so F is larger than zero. Actually, F is infinite if you consider the whole three-dimensional space, right? Or the vortex of infinite length. But if you consider the finite free energy per unit length, it's finite.
Or okay, if, thank you.
Yeah. So, good, so let's go there further. And of course, this general consideration doesn't tell you anything about the particular form of the equation. We are looking for the solution. We are looking for the solution which has axial symmetry. Why? I mean, there is no reason for this, right? You can just look in at the whirlpool in your bus stop or a tornado, I mean, and then it basically answers comes out, right? I mean, so the real vortices obey this axial symmetry. The statement is, of course, not true. I mean, and moreover, it's proven that for critical coupling, there are solutions which are not axially symmetric, right? So, but we will not consider this. We will consider the most common case, right? The axial symmetry. It basically means that the only dependence on the polar angle is in the face of the scalar field, which is like required by topology. And actually, this immediately fixes the form that of the ansatz for the gauge field, right? You only have an angular component, polar component, and then you just substitute this ansatz into the Euler equation, the field equation, and get a system of coupled equation on these two functions, F and A, right?
Yeah, so yeah, you mentioned this critical case when the vortices don't interact at all, and then like in supercritical they would repel from these lattices.
Yeah.
In subcritical they would attract.
Attract. Yeah.
Are you considering this subcritical case when they would attract and form a big?
I do not everything. I consider everything, right? We will find a solution because it's a formal solution.
We will find unstable instability, right?
Yes, and yes, they will be unstable, but still there will be. I will discuss this. Yeah, good question, but you're a little bit ahead, right? I mean, so, and here, of course, I mean, I rescaled everything. I get rid of all the parameters in the free energy functional. So the only thing which you cannot rescale out is the coupling, right? Scalar self-coupling, lambda, right? Which is in this units the critical coupling corresponds to lambda equal to one, right? Which means that for non-rescaled variables, lambda is equal to v squared. Right. If okay, good. Of course, you impose the boundary conditions, right, which tells you that the system has a finite free energy, okay, finite tension, and it's regular at the origin. So you have a system of coupled nonlinear equations with a given initial condition. The question is how to solve them. Again, if you consider Ginzburg-Pitayevsky what you call global vortices, the situation is a little bit more interesting because you have massless Goldstone boson. So actually you have a finite tension configuration only in compact space, right? I mean, so, but again, I mean, if you're interested in, and the solution will be completely different, right? And the system of equation is simple, right? You just have one. So if I have time, or if you have wish, right, I mean, will, whatever, I mean, we'll consider this afterwards, right? So right now I focus on this system of equation. And Actually, it's a system of two coupled nonlinear equations of the second order. It's basically a killer, right? So, but never, so the general structure of the solution is unknown, of course, but there are a few particular cases of the proximate solutions which are famous, right? And the first one is by Abrikosov. So it corresponds to elementary vortex n equal to 1, and the limit of lambda goes to infinity. So one can solve the equations. I mean, it's yeah, Abrikosov did it and got a Nobel Prize. For critical coupling, right, lambda equal to 1 and elementary vortex as well, one gets Taylor series, right, in R, which is completely useless. Very much like you know probably that the three-body system in classical mechanics can be solved in terms of the Taylor series, which are absolutely convergent, but absolutely useless because you cannot predict anything with them, right? And so the same situation is here. So you formally you have a series, but you cannot use it to plot the solution. And the most kind of funny example is the one by Ed Witten, right? He found that for critical coupling on a hyperbolic plane, so not on the Euclidean plane, but on a hyperbolic plane, you can actually get, I mean, the system becomes integrable, and you can find the solution for, it's actually reduced to Liouville theory, and you can find the solution for an arbitrary n. But of course, I mean, as everything what it usually does, I mean, it's very elegant, beautiful, and has nothing to do with the reality, right? I mean, so the question is, what actually happens for like large n when you're in a flat space, right? Not.
But does this hyperbolic plane introduce new parameter?
Sorry?
Does this hyperbolic plane introduce new parameter?
No, it introduces the integration factor. In a sense, the kinetic energy changes. First of all, for critical coupling, you have a factorization, and we will see this. You have only first order equation, and then this kinetic term modifies, and you can integrate it, right? I mean, the equation becomes integrable. So he derived it actually when he considered axial multi-instanton solutions. So he solved it as a part of the problem because he performed the reduction, dimensional reduction, and at some point he had this system of equation.
So you say it doesn't depend on the curvature of hyperbolic plane for any hyperbolic plane?
For a funny,
but then you can take the limit of flat.
No, it should be of non-zero constant curvature, right? I mean, it's...
That's right, but yeah. If this curvature can be relatively small, I can take the limit when it's zero. I mean, kind of restore.
No, it's singular. I mean, the limit is singular, yeah, sure.
So it's not, it would not give a vortex. I see.
This is a problem, yeah. So, an interesting question is what happens with when n is larger than 1? And again, it's really interesting because this kind of beasts they observed now in various condensed matter systems and BC condensate and in superconductors, and it's a kind of very appealing to figure out the universal properties of such solutions, right? The kind of characteristic features.
Yeah. So why do you need an analytic solution? I mean, you could always solve it on the machine, right? I mean,
yeah, but it doesn't tell you anything about like. About the property again. So the idea is
the curve of R, right? And
First of all, when you try to solve the equation for large n, so it becomes really unstable. This is one thing. But nevertheless, you don't need it for n larger than 10, right? I mean, but it's just interesting. I mean, you basically figure out how do they look like. I mean, you will see. The structure simplifies a lot, right? So it's like a question. I mean, this is a legitimate question. Like, when you consider the theory of solitons, right? Like in Kortrijk de Vries, mm-hmm. I mean, you can solve it on the computer.
Yes.
Why do you need inverse scattering problem, right?
Yes.
So this is the answer.
Because the old days they didn't have computers.
Yes. Shut up. Shut up, right?
No, I'm just trying to.
We'll see. I mean,
no, the second. stability.
The second stability will be also, we will find a lot of interesting things about stability as well, but finally it will allow us, the explicit analytic solution will let us to find zero mods.
Okay.
Which is highly non-trivial, right? I mean, if you have, I mean, I do not think that, again, you can probably solve it on a computer, but again, so you will see it's, there is a kind of a lot of beautiful things.
No, again, you will see some structure, right?
Yes, yes.
It's integrability.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And just to, yeah. Okay, so now you can actually have a look at how they look like, right? I mean, so this is in the superconductors, I mean, instead of N, they use L. So this is a vertex with a winding number 4, 3, 2, right? I mean, so they it's an X-rays of this guy, right? And if I mean, there is a problem because now of course in superconductor you have lambda larger than 1, they are unstable. They are unstable. You will see that actually they are almost stable when n goes to infinity, then become more and more stable in this case. But also they actually put it on a kind of a boundary around them, which prevent the flux quanta to run away. So this is why it's mesoscopic superconductors. It's just small pieces of superconductor. So they managed to keep them stable. And this is like cold atoms Bose-Einstein condensate. Here n equal to 60. 60 is a really large number, right? And you can see it's a kind of a donut, right? And it actually precesses, right? So they take an X-ray picture of it at different moment of times.
The paper is from 2003. Does that mean that
you've been more progress than
them?
I mean, actually, this guy, he got the boss here, he got a Nobel Prize for the discovery of Bose-Einstein condensate, and then he observed this. Of here, no. I mean, I think they have it in liquid helium for, I think, n equals 300 or something like this. So, so you can, yeah, but people are still doing this, right? I mean, I just found the nice pictures in these papers, right? I mean, so you do not often have them.
Vertexes do you form? Why do you form n equals 50 as opposed to n equals 1? Or so once, yeah, once you apply the field, what can you predict? Which vertexes will be formed?
They do it intentionally, right? I mean, so actually they use some tricks to actually to merge the elementary vertices.
So you always start with n equals 1 and then you try to merge them?
Yeah, they actually see afterwards how they dissipate and they count them, and then by counting the vertices which like are produced at the decay of this, I mean, they figure out what is n. Right. So, good.
Well, I believe number also grows with applied magnetic field, right? So you
apply here it's in BC,
yeah. Yeah, but say in because of strings, you apply a large magnetic field, you get kind of a lot of single vertices, and then they compress them, right?
Yes, yeah, in a sense, yes, yeah. So they increase the magnetic field, and then basically, since it's mesoscopic superconductor, they do not have any space to run away, and they merge. So anyhow, I mean, it was pictures, right? I mean, so now let's go back to theory, and. The problem is, of course, as I already mentioned, quite non-trivial. But fortunately, we have a very smart advice from Lev Landau long time ago. I mean, if you have a problem like this, you should find a small parameter. Maybe actually it was not Lev Landau, maybe it was Nikolai Bogalyub, but some of them definitely say this, right? So if you look at this equation, the system of the equations, you can see only two parameters, right? I mean, so one is lambda, but you cannot expand on lambda. If lambda goes to zero, it's very much like with this, with the curved space. I mean, you do not have vertices. It's a singular limit. So an alternative is n goes to infinity. And here we also have a problem. Because as you can see, the small parameter 1 over n squared is in front of the highest order derivative. This means that if you set it to 0, the order of the equation changes. And this means that the perturbation theory which you have is singular. But it looks very much like Navier-Stokes equation to some extent, because you should know that in Navier-Stokes equation in the limit of large Reynolds number or small viscosity. So in Navier-Stokes equation, the small parameter, the viscosity, is in front of the highest order derivative. So it's really not trivial to expand it. And fortunately, again, from fluid dynamics, we know actually Ludwig Prandtl figured this out in the beginning of 20th century, how to deal with this situation. And that was a revolution in fluid dynamics, so-called boundary theory, layer theory, right? So the idea is very simple. Somehow he suggested to separate fluid in two regions, at least in two regions, a boundary layer where the gradient of the velocity is very large, and you must take into account you cannot expand in the viscosity, right? So you have to keep the second order term in the equation, the second order derivative, and the rest, right? And basically use different approximation in the regions, and if like in the bulk, you can neglect the viscosity, right? So the perturbation theory which you get is actually the perturbative expansion in the scale ratio. So it's a width or depth of the boundary layer to the characteristic length scale of the bulk. And since the boundary scale depths scales as some non-rational power or non-integer power of the viscosity, right? So basically you have expansion in some square root of third root of the viscosity, something like that. Clearly the perturbative expansion is asymptotic, right? So and the perturbation theory is singular. So we can do the same, right? So we can follow the same idea. Here we should basically separate the scales, identify the correct approximation at different scales, and then somehow match the different approximations. Right then, the perturbation theory is the expansion in the scale ratio, and this is what we are doing in the effective theory all the way, right? So, but usually in quantum field theory, we use the momentum space. Here we will do the effective field theory in coordinate space. Okay, so basically what are the problem for us? So expansion parameter which we want to use is the inverse powers of like 1 over n, or some power of 1 over n. So we somehow should associate the winning number with the scale ratio. And then, again, so separate the scales, use a proper approximation in the relevant region, right? And then to match them. So how should we do this, or how can we do this, right? So let's remember the universal velocity structure, which I already mentioned, right? So basically we have the core, and we have unbroken phase, and where we have all this magnetic flux. Right, then we have a tail where we have a broken phase, basically vacuum, and then we have a kind of a boundary layer between them. So the depth of the boundary layer is, I mean, the origin of the boundary layer is a nonlinear effect, right? So the depth of the boundary layer is a order of the inverse mass of a scalar or a vector field, right? So we consider it to be of order 1. So this is the depth of the boundary layer. So what about the size of the core? So it should accommodate n flux quantum, right? So this means that the flux is proportional to the area, right? So this means that the area is proportional to square of the radius. So this means that the radius should grow like square root of n. So we have two distinct scales, right? I mean, so the depth of the boundary layer and the size of the core. So and the ratio is 1 over, the small ratio which you can make of them is 1 over square root of n. So we guess that the perturbation theory will be a theory, like the expansion in 1 over square root of n. since you have a non-integer power of n, it clearly indicates that you have a singular perturbation, right? So this is the main idea, right? So and again, we should use some approximation inside the core, outside the core, and within the boundary layer. So
the width of the boundary layer is much smaller than the size of the core, the size of the
depth. Yes, yeah.
It's a symbol approximation.
Sorry?
It's a symbol approximation for the
width. Yes, yes, in a sense, yes. Yeah, but it will not be approximation, right? I mean, so we will actually derive it, right? So we will derive even the corrections to this. So it's not like zero width wall. It's not like a theta function or whatever.
Oh no, but then you can use some ansatz, some like tangent hyperbolic parameters.
It's actually much simpler. Just wait for a moment, right? So, and just to show, I mean, and it works. It's basically like in hydrodynamics, right, or fluid dynamics, right? You have like the boundary layer, but like. It's not really boundary, it's intermediate layer, right? Between two different phases or domain well, whatever. Good. So let's see how it works in practice. And I will consider, of course, the kind of specific case lambda equal to one, the critical coupling. In this case, basically, this free energy is the bosonic part of n equal to extended SUSY QED. So instead of the second order Euler-Lagrange equation, you get the first order Bogomolnik equation, right? So, and this is why it's simpler, right? I mean, again, it's just simpler to present. An interesting situation here is that, interesting feature here is that for this coupling, the string tension is proportional to topological charge, or in this case, it's the same as a central charge, right? And it was found a long time ago by Bogomolny, long time before I think even he didn't know that it's supersymmetric or whatever. So, good. So how it works, right? So let's, in terms of this F and A functions, the system of equation is, again, it's just a little bit simpler than the second order equation. So it's easier to explain how it all works. So we have like three regions with different dynamics. So we estimated that the radius of the core should scale like square root of n, but we will see that it's square root of 2n from the explicit solution. So we have core, we have boundary layer, and we have tail, right? And let's consider the core. In the core, remember that the scalar field almost vanishes, right? So you can actually expand in this nonlinear term. So you can, the first approximation, neglect f squared. And at r equal to zero, you see this asymptotic, right? I mean, it's easy. So you have this asymptotic of the solution. It's suppressed by r, but of course, it's more important that it's power suppressed by n. So when n goes to infinity, the scalar field is exponentially suppressed with n. So even for when r is not small. So this is a very important thing. So again, if you neglect f squared because it's exponentially suppressed, you get this couple of equations for f and r and a. So a is easily solved. And here you see square root of 2 in the definition of Rn appears from the solution of this equation, right? So it gives you exactly what is the size of the core. And you can solve it for f, and your f is just f capital is integration constant. And you see that when r is smaller than Rn, it can be large, right? So because Rn is very large. So when r is smaller than Rn, it's exponentially suppressed when n goes to infinity. Right, so you can, the corrections to the solution are exponential, so you do not see them. They are exponentially suppressed in n, and of course it's asymptotic series, you do not control the exponentially suppressed terms. So, and you can see when r goes to rn, the exponential suppression disappears because this all goes to zero. And this means that we cannot neglect the nonlinear term, we actually enter the nonlinear regime of the boundary layer. So In the boundary layer, you remember that it's actually pretty narrow. Its depth is O of 1. So the variation of R can be neglected in the first approximation within the boundary layer. So you can just replace this R in this equation by Rn. So just and in principle, you can then expand in R minus Rn, which is x and which is much smaller than Rn. So it's of order of 1. So this will be our expansion parameter in a sense. So in our theory. So and then you have a nonlinear equation, but with a constant coefficients, and it's integrable. You can find the solution, right? You can find the solution. I just change from f to the logarithm of f, right, and introduce some different functions, and you have this. It's very simple nonlinear equations which can be integrated. And the solution is like you. So this is a formal solution, and to some extent, this is analog of, if you want, elliptic integral or elliptic function, right? And so instead of, you have an exponent instead of sine or cosine, and so it has very similar properties, actually, right? So, and yeah, so you actually, just to get the correct behavior at infinity and at zero, you should fix this integration constant. So it's a kind of a new irrational number, if you want, new irrational constant. What, and you can check that the asymptotic behavior of the solution is correct. So it just correct. It matches the one in the core and the one in the tail. And finally,
does it match also the exponential part? If you go, so it matches, I understand, the expansion of A, right? This x squared term, I believe. Right?
Yes.
But what about the exponential?
This one, it's infinite. It's just infinite. Yeah, this is an, yeah, this is for x positive, right? So it goes to.
Right. But then you also had some correction to the function f, which I think is now gamma, right? The function f, which were exponential inside before, right? So you had this exponentially suppressed correction. Do you get them here?
No. It's asymptotic. You don't have a control over this. Yeah.
Okay.
So. Good, and in the tail everything is clear, right? Because like A is almost one, F is almost one, so you expand in F and A, and you basically have the free massive scalar and vector propagators as usual, and like you can write down them in this form, and these parameters nu and mu, they correspond to, I mean, they have physical meaning. Nu is the scalar charge of the vertex, and mu is the magnetic dipole momentum of the vertex, right? So now we can actually bring everything together. So we have these solutions, right? So in all these three regions. So here and here the equations are linear, so they depend on the integration constant. You have three integration constant, right? The boundary layer you have a solution which is completely fixed. It's a nonlinear equation. So what you get, right? I mean, so you the last step, you just have to compare them, these solutions in the matching regions, which both approximations, like all the approximations, like this or this approximation, they are both valid. So in this way, I mean, it's easy, right? So you just perform the expansion in these regions, and you fix the all the constants of the linear equation solution and the coron in the tail. And that's it, right? I mean, so you can, like in the leading order, you found the solution of this vertex equation. But of course, I mean, this is not a big deal, right? I mean, so it's interesting to see how the perturbation theory is organized. And as I already mentioned, it's exactly what you asked about, right? I mean, so we neglect exponential terms in the core and in the tail, just because we don't have control of them, right? So the only corrections to the core and to the tail are through these coefficients, like to these matching constants, f, nu, and mu, right? So they, like before we had this. Before we had these numbers, I mean, then they will get some corrections, but the functional form will stay the same. So this means that the power corrections in 1 over square root of n come from the boundary layer only, right? And they are easy to compute, right? I mean, so you just keep these terms, right, in the boundary layer equation, and get the correction to this function W and the gamma, right? So which parameterize the scalar and gauge field in the boundary layer, and you can integrate it, and you can do everything analytically, right? And now, and actually you can go further, I mean, as far as your laptop allows you to.
So why in the tail you don't have any expansion?
Because again, remember, good question, right? So because this difference, we expand in this difference, and it's exponentially suppressed by exponent of the radius, and the radius is scales like n, right? So like all the corrections are exponentially suppressed when n goes to infinity. So, this is how it works. I mean, this is really funny, right? I mean, so this is the function f, right? And you can not even see like n equal to 10, 4, 1, and it converges pretty well, right? I mean, here it's just the boundary layer, right? I mean, so I do not perform the matching to the core, so here the convergence is bad. You will see that it's actually much better on the next slide. For A field, it also converges pretty well, right? I mean, so it converges to the solid line, right? So it's leading, next to leading, and exact. Leading, next to leading, exact, right? So this is just a value of the function f at the core radius up to n equal to 100, right? I mean, so you see. And this is a scalar charge, logarithm of the scalar charge. It's also like, it works all the way up to n equal to 1, right? I mean, but...
So why leading order for A of R doesn't work? It kind of goes to 0 somewhere, crosses. Yeah.
Because it should work only... Like, very much like here, I don't perform the matching. It's just the boundary layer. It's actually the correct question why the boundary layer works so well at the next leading all the way through, right?
I see. So,
so here I even don't perform matching, and nevertheless it works perfectly.
I see.
So, which is, yeah. So, but what is... Yeah, this is boundary layer everywhere, right? I mean, because it was difficult. I mean, and now I can show you what happens if you match it for n equal to 1. So the solid line is the vertex solution, dotted line is the leading order boundary layer, right? I mean, so like the leading order approximation. So you perform the expansion in one, right? So, and it turns out that in this particular case, 1 is a large number. If it's in denominator, right? I mean, so and you see that for n equal to like 1, we have an incredible, I mean, you have this is what I was dreamed about when I was a student, an analytic formula for the vortex. Now you have it. And don't tell me why do you need it, because you can do it numerically, blah, blah, blah. No, I mean, this is just nice. And of course, you can go, so I think I'm pretty much on time yet. So you can go to non-critical vertices. And again, you can do the same things, actually up to some redefinition, right, of this radius. There is no difference with the functional form of core and tail is the same. The equation for the boundary layer is changed, right? And it's a kind of a domain wall. I mean, you don't have a solution for like a reasonable solution of these equations for an arbitrary lambda, but you can solve it for either large lambda or small lambda. And I just don't want to, I mean, it's pretty straightforward exercise. I will just give you a kind of a solution. For example, for in the limit when lambda goes to infinity, you can get an even better analytic formula for the scalar field. And you can just look at the tension and tension behaves like this, right? So you have the leading order tension. And actually, going back to your question, you see it's proportional to n. The tension is linearly grows linearly with n. For large lambda, like the result of Abrikosov, I mean, actually, like the when you first you take lambda goes to infinity, right? I mean, so the tension grows like n squared. So they're really repelling each other. Here they're almost neutral. So the only modification is this square root of lambda. So like when it's really funny. I mean, and this is what you cannot actually guess from the very beginning, right? So when it gets bigger, it gets more stable. So this is why actually they can produce this, such a big vortices, right? So what is interesting is that when you have this lambda equal to infinity limit, so the actual expansion parameter is not 1 over square root of n, but it's rather 1 over, it's small, right? I mean, so here it is, right? So it's lambda to the power 1 over 4 over square root of n. So you cannot use this approximation when n is not just close to 1, right, formally, right, but when it's smaller than square root of lambda, right? So you should go to large n in this case. Again, because you remember that the expansion parameter is a scale ratio, and in this case we have a heavy scale ratio, it's this gauge boson mass, right, and times which scales which gives this factor, right? I mean, and here you have Rn, which gives you this factor, right? So it's a scale ratio, right? So you should always remember that the expansion parameter is a scale ratio. And when you consider the opposite limit, again, you have a kind of a simple solution. Your expansion parameter, instead of vector mass, you have the scalar mass here, right? And lambda goes to denominator, right? So the expansion parameter is not 1 over square root of n, but rather 1 over square root of n times lambda to the power 1 half. So this means that you should go to n which are larger than 1 over square root of lambda to get a kind of a convergence of this series. So, but when lambda goes to 1, I mean, actually, these both restrictions, they coincide, and I think this is why the perturbation theory works so well, right, for critical case. And anyhow, and this is a correction. I just to show you how it looks like. I mean, so this is the leading order result. This is the correction. So you can basically systematically compute the corrections to the solution. And anyhow, let's now go to the last part of the talk. No, but isn't it beautiful, Sergei? Yeah, I mean, it's really funny, right? So let's go to more PR part of the talk, this discovery of Majorana fermions, right? I told you that these guys, I mean, they claim the discovery of Majorana fermions already, and you will learn that it's not maybe really the case yet, right? So what are these Majorana fermions? Which are really hyped now, I mean, in condensed matter. So you know that, usually that when you have an electron or hole in a solid, right, I mean, the dispersion law for these quasi-particles depends strongly on the lattice, right? And it turns out that, in the materials, which are called topological insulators, there are modes which live on the surface, two-dimensional modes, for which the effect of the lattice result in a linear dispersion. So for these quasi-particles in the surface of surface quasi-particles, right, in the topological insulator, the energy scales like the momentum times, instead of the speed of light, you have Fermi velocity. So what can we do? I mean, and it was the famous kind of idea by Fu and Kane, like probably million citation now, right? I mean, they suggested to put a topological insulator on the top of a superconductor and somehow create a vortex in the superconductor and look at what happens with this Dirac fermions in this case. And what do we have? We have basically the Dirac equation and the magnetic field, right? Massless Dirac equation and magnetic field. And it's known that if the magnetic field has a a non-trivial Winnick number, right? I mean, so if it's belongs to a vortex, right? Then, just by index theorem, by some topological argument, you may predict the existence of zero energy states, zero energy modes. So the magnetic field, the vortex magnetic field, doesn't zero energy state of Dirac fermions can be actually lifted, right? Any perturbation can give a small mass to them, right? I mean, if you have a background of the vortex, the index theorem prevents this zero modes from getting the mass, right? So it's you have a zero energy state which are not prone to the perturbations. And zero energy states, they are self-conjugate. So in a sense, you can think about it in the following way. And this means that they correspond to the Majorana fermions, right? So you can think about it in the following way. You have zero energy state here. So the positive energy state is electron, negative state energy is a hole, right? I mean, so when they have a zero energy, they degenerate. So the hole is a charge conjugate of the electron, right? I mean, so you can make a neutral combinations of them. Right, so, and the neutral combination, so you can represent it as a sum of two Majorana fermions. So, when you look at the zero modes, you see that only one of these self-conjugate states survives. So you have twice as few components, like fermionic components in this zero mode than you have without a magnetic field. This actually what makes it stable, right? I mean, so you don't have an additional degrees of freedom to make a real charged fermions out of this. So, and this is what they call, I mean, this self-conjugate, the zero modes, right? I mean, they are called Majorana fermions.
Actually, why Majorana fermions? Majorana fermions actually have mass, right? So here, these are these
dots,
right?
No. Majorana fermions, they do not have to have
well,
mass.
They may or may not, right?
Yeah. In this case, they don't.
Just call them chiral fermions.
No. There is no chiral. I mean,
because it's 2+1.
It's 2+1. It's 2+1. Yeah, you don't have. You don't have chirality. You have in a sense spin, which can be like spin up, spin down, right? I mean, so but there is no chirality because the momentum is in the same in the plane, so you cannot have spin in the same plane, right? As momentum. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you don't have chirality. So and they are real. I mean, this is what distinguishes. I mean, they are really, really, you will see how it works in a moment. People just started to study this, to try to find how can you detect them, right? I mean, so you make a vortex, right? And then this zero modes, by definition, they have zero energy. So they try to test this surrounding of the vortex with the tip of the scanning tunneling microscope, and at some point you get zero bias current. And since the only states which are not gapped are supposed to be zero modes, I mean this self-conjugate modes. I mean this is considered as a proof, experimental proof of the existence of the Majorana fermions. And it was nice, well, papers in Nature and Science, and but at some point, some smart theoretician told, look, I mean, in the magnetic field, I mean, there are other non-zero modes in the system with energy which is almost zero, which is exponentially small. And they are located on the boundary of the vortex, very much like the zero modes. And how do you know that you measure the zero true zero mode and not just like the normal Dirac fermion, right? I mean contribution with very very small energy. And some of the papers were actually removed from Nature. And now I'm just going to tell you, like maybe 5 minutes, not more, right? I mean, so how the giant vortex can actually, the zero modes in the giant vortex background can solve the problem here. Because, And actually these quasi-particles, they are described, it's surprising, because like by so-called Jakey-Frosse model, and this is the equation of motion for this Jakey-Frosse model. It's like goes back to mid the 80s. And you can imagine that at this point, nobody have heard about topological insulators, all this crap, right? I mean, so they were studying like this quantum field theory phenomena in simple models. And they wrote this equation and found, like, proved the existence of zero modes. You cannot find them, right? I mean, because you don't even know the expression for the background field, right? So, but they proved that there exists n real zero modes in this model. And it turns out that the quasi-particles and this heterostructure on the boundary between superconductor and topological insulator exactly follows. I mean, this is a Bogolyubov equation, in a sense, for quasi-particles. It turns out that this the Jakey-Frosse model describes the quasi-particles is corresponding to this to this kind of systems, right? So with effective Dirac fermions. And we are almost done, right? So. And actually, you can, I mean, this zero modes, they don't have a definite angular momentum, but they can be expanded like represented as a linear combination of the partial waves. And like, if you look at this, it's not clear that they are real, right? I mean, that but they actually self-conjugate, because when you make this analogy between these fermions, right, and holes and electron quasi-particle, right? So it turns out that this guy is a kind of electron. This is a hole. This is electron. This is a hole. And the charge conjugation exchange electron and a hole. So, and you can see, so it basically goes into itself, and it also goes into itself because you have an additional I, right? So from this point of view, they are self-conjugate. But you can actually check that, for example, when n equal to 1, you have everything is, I mean, only one zero mode exists and it's just real, right? And in principle, this is a complex equation, so it should support the complex solution, right? So actually this means that only half of degrees of freedom from the fermion contribute here, the other half is zero, and this is why they are stable, they cannot be lifted, right? You need an additional, I mean, actually, I can tell you that the complex conjugate, you can also write down the equation and it will be, there will be a solution, right? But it will not be normalizable. Right, so if you are talking about normalizable zero modes, this is what you have. The second half of the degrees of freedom is non-normalizable. And you can just put it into this equation, get an equation for the partial waves, and if you have the solution for the background field, you can actually find the solution for this zero mode explicit solution, which have not been done before. And it looks really nice. So for the first half of this partial waves for L smaller than n equal to over 2, you have a Gaussian wave packets, right? Localized at this distance from the center. And if you think a little bit, you can actually guess that something like this should be the case. Why? Because what you have a kind of a core of the vortex where there is only magnetic field. So, and you have a Dirac fermion and a magnetic field, and it forms the zero Landau level. And this are the wave function for the Landau, for it's degenerate, and it just basically is a function, I mean, the particle rotating like in the magnetic field, right, at the given distance, like at the given radius, right? So it's just a Landau state. Why there is, like, it works only for n L less than n over 2. Because you remember that the vortex is made of a scalar field, which is basically a pair of electrons, right? It's Cooper pair. So the flux for the flux quanta for the scalar is twice as small, right? And this Landau states, right? This Landau states, they basically, I mean, how do you find them, right? I mean, so the charged particle basically encircles the integer number of the flux quanta defined with respect to this particle charge. So since like for the fermion, like elementary excitation, the electric charge is just half of the charge of the scalar field. So this means that the flux quanta is twice as large. So if we have n flux quanta with respect to the scalar charge, right? I mean, so only n over 2 flux quanta with respect to the fermionic charge can fit in, right? What happens with the higher states? It turns out that now, like this fermions, they are smashed against the scalar field and repelled back. So you still have a kind of a Gaussian wave packet, but they are squeezed because actually the angular momentum pushes it outward and the potential pushes them inward, right? So they are squeezed by the factor of square root of 3. And they go all the way, I mean, you can just see the expression for the localization radius for the states all the way up to Rn times 2 over 3 square root. So if you, so it's a kind of a really funny geometry. You can, when n goes to infinity, you can compute the corresponding local density of states, right? So this is the sum of these Gaussians, right? So it looks like this. So it does not depend on anything. It's a universal prediction. It does not depend on anything except the radius of the if you have the radius of the vortex, does not matter how you get it. The structure of the zero modes of the local density of states is like this. So it goes from 0 to square root of 2 over 3 of R, and here you have 1. And you can actually see, this is kind of an exact result, right? For exact sum of like 4 terms, 16 and so on terms, right? I mean, so they go to like a kind of wheel rim shape. What is nice about this, right? The nice thing about this, first of all, it's easier to measure, right? And then you remember that inside the giant vortex, you have magnetic field. So all the non-zero modes are magnetically gapped. Because zero mode, you know, it has the zero Landau level with zero energy for the massless fermion. For the massive fermion, everything starts with the first Landau level, so they are gapped. All the non-zero modes are gapped inside. So if you cook up something like this, and if you measure zero base current inside the vortex, this means that you definitely detect the Majorana state. And basically.
Sorry, but what's the gap?
Sorry.
So what's the gap?
The gap for it grows linearly with magnetic field, so it can be. It's like what is Landau level? B times.
Yeah, but that's very small, right? So.
No, B is large.
Yeah, but B it's B over mass of the electron, right? That's the.
B is the external magnetic field which you apply.
Like, one Tesla, right? One Tesla or mass of the electron.
Yeah. No, look. I mean, like Landau levels are very, very, very easily detected, right? I mean, so it's a half. Yeah, it's basically like you can easily see Landau levels, right? I mean, so in normal materials, right? It's very much like any Landau gap in quantum Hall, for example. So it's easily detected. So again, because the problem is that for n equal to 1, everything lives at the boundary of the vortex. All the non-zero or non-zero small energy states or zero states, they live on the boundary. So you have a bump here, and you cannot say whether it's zero or non-zero. You know that like here you also have, you still have this almost zero mods which live here. But here you don't have these mods because you have a strong magnetic field inside.
So why do you call them almost zero mods?
These are zero mods. But again, so the mods which cause problems, they are like if you put a normal massive Schrödinger fermion in a magnetic field, in the magnetic field of the vortex, right? It's magnetic and scale, right? You can see that there can be the states which are non-zero, but the energy is very small. So this is.
What are the states? Where do they come from?
Oh, because you just solve the Schrödinger equation in magnetic and scalar field, and you get this.
With scalars.
With scalars, yeah. It's important because, I mean, obviously, when you go here, the scalar dominates and the magnetic field vanishes, right? So they are definitely not Landau, right? I mean, so everything and...
Right. So out there, they are massive. Okay, so
they are massive? Yeah.
You say in between there is a...
Yes, yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So, and I think, yeah, I already told...
That's the discrete spectrum, right?
Inside, yes. Yeah, outside, there is a gap. I don't know actually how, like, where, yeah, I think they're gapped, right? They're gapped, right? Yeah, so you have, yeah. So the problem is that the gap of the lower state is very small mm-hmm. for outside, yeah. So, yeah, and okay, I think I ran out of time. This is a short summary, and yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, you can.
Any questions?
Yeah, I'm a bit confused. So there, rho was one half inside.
Yes, yeah.
For all of them. But, so we always, for all ends, we have some fermions inside, right?
Yes, yeah.
Somehow, from
This is asymptotic. This is asymptotic limit. Of course, I mean, like here it goes to zero clearly, because all the wave functions they vanish at the origin. So it's a kind of the problem is that for n equal to one, it looks very much like this, right? I mean, so you don't have really a bound state inside the vortex. You don't have the magnetic field because here, like, yeah.
So nobody measured these Mariana fermions on giant vortices yet?
No, I mean it's not easy. I mean again, it's as you mentioned, it's difficult to actually to make it and put also the topological insulator on the top and then the measure. I mean this is and actually it was this year paper, right? I mean so they didn't have time.
Mm-hmm. Well, but the cell they didn't try to, right?
No. There were papers. I mean, it's amazing. Like this condensed matter theorists, they to some extent they are like kids, right? I mean, so they had this solution for n equal to one, and they said, okay, the magnetic field is you can actually neglect the magnetic field completely and to consider this zero mods bound state. Yeah, even for n equal one because the effect is very small on a. And for large n, they actually, there are papers for large n, but they put magnetic field zero. Because, I mean, they do.
This whole index theorem is from gauge fields. So magnetic field is important.
You I mean, they are like kids, you know. I mean, they thought that somehow, yeah, they can gauge them. I don't know. Yeah, so, but this is funny.
Yeah, so it's funny the separation of modes into the bulk ones and the boundary things. So basically,
it's again, it's the fact that it's not a boundary because for boundary modes actually on the boundary it's difficult to predict anything, right?
On the boundary of the vortex.
Of the vortex, right? On the boundary layer is sitting here, so here all the expressions are approximate, but they are repelled, right? I mean, when L goes from n equal to 2 to n, they are like. So they're deep inside the the vortex in a sense. So it's not a boundary. I mean, it's the boundary you cannot see here, right? The boundary goes to zero, the boundary layer depth.
So this 0.8 is a limit already.
It's a square root of 2/3 times Rn. So it's the ratio of this. Well, I mean, it's funny. Yeah.
Can you make predictions about the 3D structure of these vortices? Like if you break axisymmetry or if you or like vertical extensions, are they different modes that can live there if they're stable?
The vertical, I mean, everything is two-dimensional in practice, right? Because all the states are boundary states. Like in this topological insulator, only the boundary states, literally the states on the surface, they actually have this linear dispersion. So everything is, so you don't care about the extension, right? I mean, yeah, so in this sense, everything is three-dimensional. But concerning the non-axially symmetric, I told you, for critical coupling, it's known that they do not interact. So basically, you have actually exactly n bosonic zero mods corresponding to the coordinates of the vortices. It doesn't have to be, I mean, it doesn't have any symmetry, right? But definitely, you have symmetric as well, right? Here, in real life, I mean, you need the type 2 superconductor where lambda is larger than zero. And I think you only have spherically axially symmetric solution, right? I mean, so because if it's not, it's unstable, but it's a solution, right? If you just modify it a little bit, it runs away.
Yes, I'm a bit confused. So in this insulator, you say scalar field is important, so scalar field is condensate of electrons. So it also penetrates into the insulator, you say? Because yeah,
it's on the boundary. Yeah, of course. I mean, this is. Where is this? This is the value of the condensate of the Cooper pairs on the boundary, right?
But I mean, here, yeah, the fermions interact.
Yes, it's yeah. This quasi.
So basically, these are the same electrons.
No, they are different. Like the electrons, the quasi particles inside the superconductor, they are gapped.
Yes.
And there is a like, and these are the particles which live on topological insulator. But since you have a heterostructure, right? I mean, so they interact with the condensate.
Through electric fields,
scattering. Yes, yeah.
I'm still very confused about the energetics. I don't understand. Like, because you want to do some X-ray microscopy to see the electrons that are around the vortex, right?
No, here it's even inside. Yeah.
So you're somehow talking about X-ray energies because you need to resolve the vortex, which is very small, so you need that.
Oh, it's not. I mean, I have shown you the pictures,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
So they basically what they need to do, they need to kind of probe this with the tip of the tunneling. Yeah,
I understand that. But then again, so the Landau levels for a 1 Tesla field, 1 Tesla divided by mass of the electron is 1 milli electron.
Yeah, but it's not the mass of electron.
No,
it's effective. No, it's effective mass. No. No. It's you're confusing. It's not a free electron. It's a quasi particle.
Yeah, that's
so the mass is much smaller than the.
Yeah, that's precisely my question. So then, what's numerically the gap?
I do not remember.
I see.
You would better ask the condensed matter physicist who thinks that there is no magnetic field.
One milli electron, this is not measurable. You understand? Because
no, of course. No. I mean, it's not.
No, but
it's not this quasi particles. Yeah.
Go with the tunneling color.
Yeah, but you need X-rays or something with energy of kV to resolve the area around the vortex because you really want to.
No, they do not make. I mean, the X-ray was for the global vortices for cold atoms. I think the picture for this picture is done exactly with the tunneling microscopy. This one, it's done with a tunneling microscopy, and they can even measure the superconducting gap, so which is supposed to be So which is supposed to be, yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, they yeah, sure. I mean, they can distinguish between the superconductor and non-superconducting states, right? So
doesn't give them like milli electrons.
For the
but I understand
yeah.
that if the mass of the electrons is really small, so actually the gap may be numerically super high.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's not even necessary to have it very high, right? Yeah.
Because so my naive intuition is that these vortices are a few lattice sizes big, right? So that's KV in size. The size of an atom is a KV. So you need, if you want to.
No, the mass is different. The mass is different. Of course, it's not
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so if you want to image this thing, you need to somehow image with KV energies. But if you were to take for the Landau level splittings the mass of the electron, which he's correcting me that I shouldn't do that, if you were to take the mass of the electron one with a 1 Tesla field, 1 Tesla over one electron, or like a 500 kV,
yeah.
which is the mass of the electron, that's 1 milli electron volt.
No, I don't understand, but that's too.
So that energy is impossible to resolve unless, as he's correcting me, I shouldn't take the mass of the electron. I should take the mass of these electrons, which are really light.
For sure.
That's quite good, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm still confused why this 10, it's still the 10 Kelvin, right? 1 milli electron volt. Right, something like 10 kilo. That's a big energy problem.
It sounds like binary, but then you have a probe on it, which needs to resolve KV. So that.
No, I will do this tunneling microscope.
Yeah, I mean they basically look at the zero bias current, because these modes they start to actually provide the current through the tip at zero bias, right? And your resolution is basically the resolution of the voltage which you can apply. I mean, there is another question because. There is another question because they have.
Tunneling, whatever.
But
yeah.
If you put a probe there, then my question would be, what energy uncertainty
yeah.
do we introduce by putting
no,
the probe?
No, I understand.
That's
that.
My question. But then.
With this tunneling story.
They're doing. Yeah.
Milli electron volt.
Yeah. That's a lot. That's 10 Kelvin. I mean, huge.
Sure.
Well,
no, this is the. This is not the problem. Again, I mean, they are talking. I mean, what they are talking, they are fighting with much like really. I mean, they cannot distinguish the zero from like exponentially zero mods, right? I mean, so like, and the gap, the it's called the milli gap, right? I mean, so they struggle to kind of resolve this, and the magnetic like Landau level for them, it's easy, right? Yeah.
So. 100 nanometer size.
Yeah. It's big, yeah.
How long lived are these vortices?
These are forever.
Forever, they just last forever.
Yeah, they are stable again because you see, I mean, they put it again on a slide. They want to somehow run away, right? Because the lambda is larger than one.
I see.
But since they put them on the kind of mesoscopic, like the small piece of,
okay.
So like this, the boundaries of the cavity, they basically bring them together.
Yeah, and the size is not.
Size is yeah, I mean,
it's, right? It's in superconductors.
It's like
hundreds.
Yeah, the size magnetic. It's yeah, magnetic or correlation. I mean, they are approximately the same, right? Yes.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, for superconductors.
Yeah.
They're actually big.
Yeah, they're big. I mean, yes.
It's 100 nanometers. Yeah.
Right.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Good.